The broadcast is now starting. All attendees are in listen-only mode.
A very warm welcome to everyone on the line to this live session at Best Ideas 2021. It's truly a great pleasure and privilege for me to welcome back to this forum Bob Robotti, founder, president, and chief investment officer of Robotti & Company Advisors, a registered investment advisor based in New York City. Guided by the classic tenets of value investing, Robotti & Company uses a proprietary research approach to identify companies with solid balance sheets and the ability to generate significant amounts of free cash flow, yet are misunderstood, neglected, or simply out of favor. Once identified, Robotti's investment team focuses on deep primary industry and company research to select investment holdings through the lens of a long-term business owner. Bob is a long-term business owner and, in fact, sits on several public company boards as well. Before founding Robotti & Company in 1983, he was the CFO of Gabelli & Company. Bob holds a BS from Bucknell University and an MBA from Pace University. And I'm sure by now, pretty much everyone in the MY Global community knows and appreciates the immense contributions that Bob and his team have made to the community. And we are truly grateful to you, Bob, for your time today. I will now turn it to you. Please go ahead.
Thank you, John. And thank you all on the MOI Global Committee for joining in this morning. Appreciate it very much. So first, I want to reflect on, hindsight, of course, is said to be 2020. But of course, that may be the year we just went through, but the past is not prologue to what the future is. And it's been an interesting year, of course, that it's forced us all to examine kind of what we do and how we think about things. And in that process, in reviewing our investment approach, we are steadfast in citing the belief that from our experience, valuation is the key to investing. So at Robotti, we have always been, will always be, unabashed value investors. It's an investment approach that's proven itself to work over the decades, centuries, again, over my 40 years of investing experience for sure. And why is that? As with all investments, it comes back to the valuation. So today I wanna talk about where we find value frequently. And there's many places to look for securities that are mispriced, but one of the clear areas that we focus in on is companies that are cyclical, because we think that difficult times for cyclical businesses provide opportunities for entry prices into the business and yet a significant runway for growth and opportunity over an extended period of time. And frequently, cyclical businesses might be commodity businesses. And at difficult times in the process, the balance sheet may be levered and not fully unlevered. The critical question is the financial viability of the business through that difficult time. But we'd also point out that, investor checklists have become extremely popular. And there's a lot of reasons and 10 years of experience to check the box and not look further at companies that are cyclical, tied to commodities, may have some leverage on the balance sheet. But yet we'd also highlight that, as Sir John Templeton said long ago, to perform better than the market, which is our goal, you have to do something different from the rest of the market. So in order to outperform also, we think it's clear that an investor needs some kind of edge to differentiate them. And here are three edges that we think are critical potential opportunities for people to outperform the market. And the one that we focus in on is really the behavioral edge, right? In all our investing, we take a long-term view and we have an ability to tolerate market swings. And that's a euphemism. Swings is a euphemism for prices moving down against you. Our behavioral edge, and why can we do that? Because over the 40 years, time and again, that's proven to be an extremely productive way and an effective way to outperform the market. Given that behavioral edge, we also think about an information edge and an analytical edge. And that is, what's the information we're looking for? Most of the information that crowds the world today, and there's more of it, and there's more news sources, and therefore more data and information, really is focused on the short term. And so we're really looking to cull out what's relevant for the longer term implications, the risks and the opportunities in a business that we're investing in or interested in investing in. And then again, that analysis is predicated on that longer term view. So that also mitigates how much data we have to process and helps us focus in on what we think is relevant and important. So specifically, the industry I want to talk to you about today, because I think it's a kind of beginning to middle show of how this works and why we think there are opportunities. And specifically in home building, we began to invest in the business in May of 2009. So post the financial crisis, of course, the financial crisis was driven by home building in America, right? It was the mortgages given to people in America who did not have the financial capability to service that mortgage and keep that home. The default of that and the implications and the leverage from that really did cause the world financial crisis. And in the process, home building activity in America went from a new all-time high of 1.8 million single-family homes down to, you know, less than 500,000 single-family homes, a new all-time low in America, right? And even though the population, there's one slide in the slide here, starting from the lower left-hand side, going across the right, is the population of America over that 50-year time horizon has more than doubled. The number of households have more than doubled. So therefore, the number of homes needed is growing. So there's a demographic movement that is clear and undeniable here. And yet to have home activity, new home activity fall to that level, we thought was clearly an opportunity. So what I also wanted, any situation, of course, is not only specific to the facts, but it's also what's the world in which it exists. And we wrote in our year-end letter a year ago that we thought the decade of 2010 was a unique decade. And unique is a word I hate people when they use it, because first off, I dislike best and worst, because those superlatives are so strong. And unique, oh, what's unique? Now, in spite of the fact that I'm very hesitant to use that phrase, I really do think that that's an accurate characterization of what that decade was, right? So you did have, in the US, definitely, the weakest recovery of all times. And of course, since it was the weakest recovery of all times, you didn't have a boom. And because you didn't have a boom, you didn't have a bust. And so it also was a unique decade in terms of there was no recession in America. So what happened, of course, is post the financial crisis, many things, including Fed activity and feeding money into the system, has helped the country, but it hasn't. In our minds, what you've really done is there's a drug that's being provided and the patient is effectively almost comatose. And so therefore, that's a very strange thing. Now, in that process, right, you've also taken inflation, you know, down, and not only the last decade, but that's a 30, 40-year period where inflation has significantly and almost disappeared. At the same time, obviously, interest rates have disappeared. So the idea that those two things, those are unprecedented. And yet, it's been a long period of time that that's continued to happen. So now it's permeated the idea that this is the new norm, that governments finally have figured out how to keep, how to eliminate inflation, and that interest rates will stay low forever. Maybe that is the new norm, maybe that's not the new norm, and we question that. So specifically in home building, so we started to look at it in 09. What we do is in these cyclical businesses, we try to look at as many opportunities and understand businesses because they're all interrelated. And so how does that all fit together? Where are the opportunities to invest? And frequently when we're looking to invest in cyclical businesses, we're also looking to identify better businesses, better managements, differentiated products. So therefore, the things that any investor would look for in terms of barriers to entry, opportunities for improved returns, and the ability to continue to consolidate the industry and improve its competitive position. So, and frequently what we do is we didn't invest in the home builders themselves, right? And we don't invest in effectively the gold miners. Instead, it's the picks and shovels guys, right? Because those are businesses that have more predictability, and it's easier to model out at a normal activity level in the industry, what's the earnings power of those businesses? And those businesses also have significant opportunities to improve that position. So that's what we did, was we focused in on the distributors mainly, although many of the product companies are key to understanding the distribution business, but also, you know, there's huge consolidation that went on in the worst home building activity depression in the United States ever. Specifically, the company we want to focus in on is Builders FirstSource. So it's a leading distributor of building products, including prefabricated components and value-added services a critical element and a critical growth and profit opportunity for Builders FirstSource. It has about 200 million shares outstanding. It's a $40 stock, so a little over an $8 billion market cap. It does have $1.9 billion in debt, $60 million in cash, so therefore a modest amount of debt, very low level versus its ability to service that. As we say, cyclical businesses are interesting because we think that there is a clear pattern that has been identified long ago. So Graham talked about the opportunity of investing in cyclical businesses, the discount that the market will give you at certain times because everybody assumes the current activity is the new norm. At the same time, long before even Graham Shumter had identified his process of creative destruction, which we think is critical and regularly recurs in these cyclical businesses. Now, the cyclical downturns, of course, are bumpy, right? And they're very difficult to predict where's the bottom, how when's the recovery, how long does it take? All of those things are great from the point of view of that defers both market participants from taking action, but it also scares away investors and therefore affects the price and therefore further reduces the business and its valuation relative to the earnings power of the business in a normalized environment. The uncertainty of when normalization occurs is, you know, a critical element that provides that opportunity. And what we also say is that that process does lead to significant retooling of the business itself internally, opportunities for consolidation, business expansion, business improvement. So it's a very cathartic process for the company itself to improve that its long-term earnings power, especially relative a weakened and narrowed down competitive environment. So here's from 2009 and 10, new all-time lows. The business recovered on a slow basis. And of course, it wasn't a straight line recovery, but it bumped up and down. So for Builders FirstSource, so halfway from where we are today, in 2015 at the end of the year, was a critical time for consolidation. So Builders FirstSource went out and bought the largest competitor in the industry, levered up to do that, but in the process took a significant amount of money out of SG&A. And so it was a $600 million market cap company pre the acquisition, taking out $120 million on the consolidation. It added $600 million of value almost overnight through that acquisition. The stock price doubled. So that's what happens. Those are opportunities that are provided in the process. The number three guy here is BMC, who at the end of 2015 also merged with, was a private company, merged in with a public company, and therefore doubled its size to almost $3 billion of revenues. I was a member of the board of BMC from 2012 to 2015, and one of the two people who negotiated the transaction from the BMC side, reverse merging at the Stock Building Supply. The third quarter this year in August, a transformative acquisition was announced, and that is that Builders FirstSource would merge on an all-stock combination with BMC. And so this is creating by far the largest competitor in the industry, but it's not only the size and the scale and the scope and the buying power advantages that it has over competitors, but the products they offer, the range of products, the value-added services, that which are critical to reduce the amount of materials needed, which are in short supply today and high priced, to reduce the amount of labor needed, again, in short supply and expensive, and to reduce the cycle time for home builders so that from time of home start to finish and to be able to sell the home is shortened down. So therefore reduces how much capital they have invested and increases their rates of return. So therefore very value added to their customer base and very differentiated from the customers and an opportunity for growth in revenues and profitability. The slide on the right hand side does show the breakdown of the revenues, and the largest component of revenues is lumber and sheet goods, 30%, which is the sale of pieces of lumber and oriented strand board. And so therefore a lower margin business, but the conversion to the value add where they make components significantly increases the revenue contribution of the same amount of wood being sold. It reduces, as I say, the inefficiencies in terms of the waste and also significantly improves the margins. So therefore this is a clear identifiable driver of top line and bottom line improvement in the next few years. The combination of the two businesses, we do actually even harken back, right? As I said, the combination a builder's first source when they bought ProBuild took $110 million of cost out of the combined company. And Stock Building Supply merging with BMC took another $50 million for that company out of the difference. So, and then today you see the combination of these two businesses, right? So substantially changing their position kind of in the competitive landscape. And here, this slide even more emphasizes it because it shows in 2007, you know, who the largest, the top five participants, distributors in the business. So today the new Builders FirstSource is the combination of four of the five largest distributors back in both 2007 and 2008. So it is a radically condensed competitive landscape, improving the position for Builders FirstSource. What it also does highlight is the volatility of the business. It may be hard to see, but back in 2007, the estimated industry revenues were over $300 billion. And then in 2009, with the depression in home building, right, that number fell to only $100 billion. So as we said, one of the things about our investments in these businesses, we tend, the opportunity and the turnarounds tend to be long. And so that means we get to know the business really well. We get to know the managements well. We get to know the board members of the companies well, because we think that's critical as an owner to be active with the business to communicate to people that we really are interested in the long-term opportunities and how to maximize those. That active engagement sometimes takes the form of board membership, either recommendations of people or ourselves being on the board. That's what happened here. In BMC, post its bankruptcy, we accumulated a very significant stake. And from 2012 to 2015, I was a board member. Now, the relevance of that is really the understanding it gives as a board member, the breadth of the business, the complexity of the business, all the different aspects of the business. Here you have an industry where home building in America is not as homogenous as one might, if you think about it, you'll realize that, right? Because home building is different in Seattle than it is in Denver, than it is in Jacksonville, than it is in Dallas. Those markets are all different with different participants, different products, different processes. And so therefore, there's a lot of complexity to understanding this business. What it also does is, okay, so what are we distributing? Are we distributing something like oriented strand board? And do we see the price of that fall apart? And why does that happen? And what opportunity might that give us for other investments in the industry outside of the investment where we're sitting on the board? That's exactly what happened here. One of our investments that I also want to talk about today is Norbord. It's the largest oriented strand board producer in North America. And that's what it is. A lot of the oriented strand board, lumber products, all the things that are made in Canada. But the North American market is one homogeneous market that is sourced out of those places. So they're the number one in the North American market. They're a leading low-cost producer. They do value-added services. And it's a $3.3 billion market cap company. As we said, in the process of cyclical industries going through difficult times, there's a radical change in the structure of the industries. And so therefore here you've got a shrinking down of who the competitors are. So many fewer people controlling the market. And also you have more intelligent competitors. After some process, maybe not when things are at the bottom, they become very undisciplined. But as the improvement starts to happen, it falls into place because the business does start to improve. And then therefore you think about it in a very different way. And that's what you have here. So Louisiana Pacific, the number two competitor, also a critical element was 2 or 3 years ago, its board and its management changed. And they became focused not on top line revenue growth, but really on profitability. And so that's been a critical element to therefore improve the profitability outlook for the industry, we believe. Busy slides here, but the bottom one is the key one I want to focus on, and that is the industry capacity for making oriented strand board. So obviously in the middle of the decade, in 9, 10, 11, right, the capacity shut-ins were significant. And so what's happened is the business has recovered slowly over time. And so that means those shuttered plants have now come back online, including a number of other changes. But today, industry capacity utilization is levels, and the latent idled capacity is extremely de minimis. We'll give you more of a picture on that. This is a picture that shows the location of the plants and the price history, what you have for oriented strand board, which is, we think is critical for why we, when to enter into this business, but more importantly, what investors think about, oh, this business is cyclical, the prices always come down. Historically, it has. But we think that that's missing the fact that the industry capacity obviously 10 years ago, there was significantly greater capacity than productive demand. That's not the case today. And yet over time, as those plants came back online at various points, prices had run up. Therefore, you bring a plant on, prices crash down. So everybody knows when prices go up, you bring on new capacity and it falls apart. The fact of the matter is there's extremely limited capacity to bring online today. And by extremely limited, it's a 27 billion board foot capacity business. There are two plants that aren't running. One of them, Norbord, has announced that they're opening, given their inability to meet the demand in the current environment. And that's a 500 million board foot plant. And there's another plant that Louisiana Pacific owns, a different price point, different cost structure. So we'll come online differently when the market demand gets there. So not simultaneous plants open also at the same time. And that's an 800, 900 million board foot plant. But between them, that's less than 5% of the current capacity. So therefore, those are the abilities to flex up the production of oriented strand board. We think extremely limited. And therefore, that's what we think here. This is the volatility in price. Again, investors in this business know the volatility in price. And if the price goes up, they're sure it's coming back down. Well, that really is not predicated on historical volatility. Too many times in the world, we see people say like, well, when it gets to this point, you know that the price always comes down. Or when it gets to that point, the price goes up. Well, what are the facts underlying that? Does that make sense? Or is that's historical pattern for some other reason? And the facts today are very different. That's what we think here. The facts today are very different in terms of the demand for the product and capacity utilization and therefore pricing and profitability. Now, just a couple of weeks ago, Norbord agreed to be merged with West Fraser Timber. Now, West Fraser is in the lumber business, which is similar but different. It's a totally different business, totally different plants. Yes, they go to the same end markets, so therefore some of the same drivers, and those drivers are extremely strong in terms of home building activity, demand, plant utilizations, also very high levels of capacity utilization, strong pricing power, and it's not only new homes, right, which we still think is at a very modest level of activity, but it's also one of the slides here, there's four different pieces, right? One of them is the aging U.S. housing stock, right? So in 1993, the average home in America was 27 years old. Today, it's 42 years old. So that's significant also for repair, remodel, and replacement, because many of those homes built in the 50s and 60s today are candidates to be torn down when they're sold by the 80-year-old who moves out of it. And the 50-year-old couple who moves in puts up a building that's twice as big that really suits modern needs in terms of square footage, layouts, all of those things. So there's a replacement cycle that's also significant in terms of adding incremental demand. What there also is in the timber business and oriented strand board businesses, there's an increasing problem of raw material supply. So British Columbia over the last decade plus has had beetle kills, forest fires, many different things. And as a result, in the top right-hand corner, you see the harvestable timber continue to decline over the next decade. That can't be changed. You can't accelerate the process for growing a tree. And so therefore, some of the raw material price availability is also constraining the ability to supply and therefore improving utilizations, improving price and profitability for the participants. And it's also, again, we're looking for better businesses that have attributes and managements that understand how to improve the underlying business, even if it is cyclical. So here, the specialty business that Norbord does is grown significantly. So it's probably almost 25% of their business today. And the pricing on that is different. And what it also does is this absorbs capacity out of the home building, ability to service home building. So effectively, you're tightening further supply-demand characteristics. And it's not just building products and selling products outside the home building industry, but it's also Louisiana Pacific converting oriented strand board plants into siding plants, which is a better business for them with a double-digit growth rate and higher profitability and predictability in pricing. So another idea that capacity is being withdrawn from the market even as demand continues to accelerate. Repair remodel is a critical element. It's grown dramatically, will continue to grow, especially given COVID world. Everybody in America is thinking about my home, what's it like, what do I do? Do I want an extra room? Do I want to, all of those things are driving incremental activity in terms of the repair remodel, which then absorbs lumber, it absorbs oriented strand board, and a lot of those products distributed by the building distributors. And here's a graph that kind of really emphasizes the long-term opportunity from here, right? The bottom graph I have, and so I'm terrible with drawing lines, but you could see it, where we got to, right? It was a new all-time low in America in terms of home building activity. Now, of course, that made some sense because the 2 or 3 years before, you built quite a few more homes than you needed to buy. Those had a recycle back. They came back to the market. And therefore, you didn't need to build a new home when you could buy one that's 2 years old and renovate it and move back into it. But the activity level, and the other fact I want to point out is the line that slopes from the left up to the upper right, that's the population growth, an estimate of what it looks like. So the population number of homes have doubled in the country. So the idea is, right, this industry we thought would return to its normalized 50-year number of 1.1 million. We think that that's an extremely conservative number, given the population has doubled and the number of households has doubled over that period of time. So the demographics would argue that no, the on a go-forward basis, you'd clearly need a much higher level, especially if you also think through there's a lot of replacement of older homes that were built in the 50s and 60s. And there was a significant amount of home building in America then. So the activity level, one would think, clearly is much higher than what it historically had averaged over 50 years. But that's the assumption we had. And now, post-COVID, we're probably there. Pre-COVID, we still were at a level that equaled probably the previous all-time lows, right? It's the same building activity that happened during the SNL crisis in the early 90s. So the idea that with two-thirds of the population, we had the same level of home building activity in a very difficult financial environment. So we think that there's a very strong driver here for opportunity. But also another demographic trend that you can't kind of ignore is the aging of the millennial population. Millennials, that's the age group that tends to be people who form households, first-time home buyers. So the demand from that group, we think, is clear and demonstrable. What we also, of course, think is that the COVID world, have really changed things dramatically. And so that's why we talk about, or the idea that Charlie Munger came up with was the Lollapalooza. So you have all these trends, underbuilding, growth in the demographics and population, yet mitigated by the fact that over the last decade, people have had a preference for urban living. And suddenly, now you superimpose on that COVID and people's responses to that and people's thoughts about where they want to live, the price at which they want to pay, how much square foot they can get for the price they pay. Do they have a backyard? So all of these things we think are coming together to form clearly an extremely strong and extended recovery, and recovery still only getting back to what the historic 50-year average is. And we just can't see how that would be the logical number on a go-forward basis in terms of what the country needs for the demographics that it has, with an increasing interest in single-family home ownership, given COVID, work from home, all these other issues that clearly are the positive demographic trends. So the new builders first source, right, really is a company with 8.2 billion market cap, but it's not the cost savings, right? There is 140 million that they're saving in terms of the combination, but that's the identifiable easy part. The real advantage is the combination that this really brings to the businesses, the concentration in certain markets. So in large home building markets, the two, in many cases, were the number one and number two competitors. So the competitive position and the competitive position in value-added services of both BMC and builders is differentiated from most of the competitors. The ability to invest in that, the ability to service the clients, the home builders, the demand of home builders in terms of the huge number of new home orders they've received. We think the company is uniquely positioned to deliver things in a different way with a different value add proposition that is differentiated. And here's a slide I want to say. People talk about investing in cyclical businesses. They say, where's the bottom? That's a problem. But you're going to trade out of it because you're not in it for a long period of time. And it's too soon. Let's wait for it to recovery to happen. So all of those, there's so many reasons why people say, it doesn't make sense to invest in cyclical businesses. And we would say, here's our experience, right? So Builders First Source, we first invested in it in 2009. And it was probably around 340 as our entry price in May 2009. And as most value investors, it frequently happens, we're too soon. So, in 2011, we were able to buy the stock down at $1.70 a share. And so therefore continued to buy, given our conviction that the business was a survivor and a consolidator and had significant opportunities. And of course, today the stock's probably close to $40 a share. So it's had dramatic improvements over time. So even as it's unfolding, there's a significant opportunity for the play out in the marketplace for you to get good returns. What also happens is never a linear straight line progression, two steps forward, one step back. And so in the interim, there have been three periods of time where the stock had a 50% decline as the story continued to unfold. And so therefore, you get these entry points with a high conviction that all of the trends are moving in the right direction, but there's a bump in the road. Someone added capacity. Someone did something, so pricing came down. The home building slowed down. Interest rates ticked up, so activity slowed down. So all those things make for some interim issues, but those all provide great entry points in. And you know, here, as we point out, we spoke about this idea over a decade ago in Graham and Dodsville newsletter. Here's some rough estimates of what we think the business clearly has the capability to do in the next few years. And we think that the, you know, with a modest multiple of earnings, and that's the whole thing, right? We're talking about valuation really does matter. So it's pretty easy to lay out an investment case here where in the next few years, the revenues, the profitability in this business, we're buying it today, even today, up from where it was to the current stock price, up 20 times, there's still a significant opportunity because the level of activity in home building is still dramatically below the demands of the demographics of the country. Here's a slide that you know highlights that we do own over 1% of Builders FirstSource. And in closing, I wanna leave you with a couple of thoughts. And so that is, really, that we think the past is not always prologue to the future. That we've been through a unique decade, the decade of 2010. Complacency that there's a new world order is here to stay permeates the investment world. We have a different lens. Buying businesses at modest levels of historic earnings at low multiples provides a way to win. That we are convinced of that. For these reasons, we continue to do intensive bottom-up stock research on businesses to estimate their future cash flows, all with the interest to invest in businesses that we think the market is mispricing for a multitude of reasons. It's a proven way to generate strong returns, rarely practiced today. It's understandable given that the last decade's unique, that people who've been in the market for 10 years, this is the only world they know. For them to be convinced that this is the way the world really does work makes sense. And for people who've been in it for much longer, a 10-year period of time really does help convince people, well, this is the new norm. Why should it change? And yet, we don't think that's the case because we all know that in the end, the market is a weighing machine and it weighs the value of future earnings and cash flows. And that's the critical part of bottom-up stock research. So there's some saying in recent times that there's a renaissance in value investing, that there's a rebirth. We resoundingly say no. Because value investing never died, it may have been hibernating for a while. We therefore continue to be unabashed value investors. We may be mislabeled and poked at and prodded at, made fun of, and even cast aside by investors. But our strategy, the basic tenets of investing in good businesses with barriers to entry, with consistently continue to do just what the differentiated focus on a confluence of market, industry, and business cycles, and an active and ongoing engagement with the management of our investing companies is a tremendous advantage to such unprecedented and uncharted COVID times. Remember, valuation is key. Given the extraordinary opportunities that abound, the ideas discussed that are just in the middle innings here in home building, we believe that we are experiencing a true stock picker's nirvana for rational, fundamental investors. Ere we say valuation investing, versus value investing. Valuation is critical and key, and it always will be, and it is today. Thank you very much.
Bob, thank you so much for this wonderful presentation. A reminder to everybody listening, if you do have a question, feel free to type it into the online interface at this time. Bob, could you elaborate a little bit more on the regional trends you see in housing and how Builders FirstSource aligns with those?
Sure. There clearly already has been a trend in America, right? So the movement of population is to the south and to the west. And we think that, you know, clearly is going to accelerate for a multitude of reasons, right? You know, the financial stresses of every government, you know, state, municipal, federal government, is going to continue to drive that, right? So, you know, here I live in New York,
I just can't see how there's not continued migration out of New York into places like Florida. Texas is just the Dallas market is not an oil and gas market, right? So Texas is not an oil and gas state. It's much more diverse than that. So the population continues to move south. There's more land, there's availability. Land is a constraint, right? In building homes, that's one of the constraints, is definitely the availability of land. And if you're in a densely populated place, it's more difficult. In open areas, it's a lot more opportunity. So it continues to shift. And those are markets in which Builders FirstSource and BMC have significant concentration and market share and the product offering. So therefore, a market like the Texas market. And so whether that's, there are four large markets in Texas, and there's many other smaller markets too. And the four markets are all different, right? San Antonio is not the same as Houston, and Dallas is different. And Austin, of course, is its own world, plunked down in the state of Texas. So there's a significant movement to the south. And west, of course, the movement is a little bit away from California, right? High taxes, difficult issues, a lot of things are causing people to move to Arizona, Nevada. And so, again, excellent markets for home building activities and for Builders FirstSource and the positions they have in those markets. So population movement is also a critical element, because if they move to a new area, you can't move the home from Wisconsin or New York or New Jersey. You got to build a new one. So therefore, population shifts are critical, and we think that will accelerate in the next decade.
Well, it certainly remains to be seen what impact COVID will have on the propensity of folks to leave cities and go to the suburbs or even rural. Not just COVID, but also the ability to work remotely seems like that's it's a growing trend. Another question. Yeah, go ahead.
And that trend feeds on itself, right? So again, I'm in New York, right? And I'm also 67 years old. So I lived in New York in the 60s and 70s when there was mass migration out of New York and the tax base declined, and that accelerated the movement out of New York. And so all of those things have the potential to replay themselves here, right? With the response of governments is there's just no way the city of New York is going to spend less money on a go-forward basis, given the demands of the population and who's going to drive the next mayor and what that mayor is going to do. And what's the response to that? What do you have to do? You have to raise money, therefore, the city does. What does it do? It raises taxes. The mobility of people today is significantly greater than what it was in the 60s and 70s. So the idea that you can work from home, work from any place, is very different. So therefore, the risks to New York, in my mind, having been through that experience, and I was too young to fully experience it, but I knew it, right? The first security I ever bought was a New York City Housing Authority bond at 33 cents on a dollar, because New York was going bankrupt. So that will aid and abet continued movement and cycles of people that I think is an extremely strong and unlikely to get turned around. And COVID really kicked off. And that's what it is. It's another one of these, what did COVID kick off that potentially ends up being a very long-term trend? And that, I think, could be one of them.
Absolutely. Bob, another question from the queue. How do changes in material pricing affect margins for Builders FirstSource, I assume, and how well are they able to pass on price increases to the builders?
Yeah. So it's a great question. First off, easy question. Higher prices, since the margins are fixed percentages, means more dollars of profit. And so therefore, now there are periods of time historically, right, as prices move up or prices move down, in the short term, it may mitigate what the profitability is, which again gives, so that's historically sometimes. But when I first invested in this business, the idea was, you wanted prices to run down, because then that meant you were able to hold your older price that you had given to someone, and therefore the cost was less, and therefore you made more margin. Well, the fact of the matter was, no. In 2009 and 10 and 11, no matter what happened, if the price of the commodity went down, the customer wanted the new lower price and could get it because someone would supply. So supply-demand is as critical as the movement of commodity prices. And I'd suggest today that it's the reverse. Somewhere in the middle, the CEO, Floyd Sherman of Builders FirstSource, said to me, relationships with suppliers could be a critical element, because availability in difficult times is the key question for a home builder, not the price. Right. If he doesn't get that lumber oriented strand board, he can't complete the home. He's less concerned about the price he pays. And so that's what I think is really changing today too. The supply demand dynamics, the strength in the market means that the distributor has more power, pricing power, to mitigate when prices move down. He's not giving that back to the supplier. He's providing them the product and they're happy to get the product. He's changing how he delivers it too. If he does these value-added service and he gives them components as opposed to gives them a piece of lumber that the guy can check the current price of. When he gives them a component, there's labor embedded in that. There's a lot more difficult in terms of constructing the cost structure. So I actually think in the current environment, that's a really strong positive. And what you also have is there are fewer suppliers, right? And so many products, so in doors, right? Masonite and Gelwin are the two manufacturers of the doors. They have 80, 90%, maybe more market share. So that's a duopoly. So therefore, some of these people have pricing power in the products that they sell and distribute. And there's a symbiotic relationship between distributor and supplier because higher price makes more money for both of them. It isn't that it comes out of the other's pocket. It means higher price, I sell it for more. I have a higher dollar margin. Therefore, I'm not fighting against it, especially if I can have absorption into the end market because my builder needs the product and wants the product to complete the home, to sell his home, to make his profit, which are at record levels also. So there definitely is a virtuous cycle that's happening today and mitigating what historically may have been problems with short. And again, that's a short-term earnings thing. Clearly, higher prices, positive for distributors, more dollars of margin.
Bob, a more general question from the queue. How has your active engagement with management been an advantage or a hindrance in the COVID era? Do you have an edge in communicating with teams given your relationship?
Well, I think so. I think clearly, right, managements did a great job also of maybe initially ducking their heads. But even then, you know, we found, you know, they were accessible. They may not know, and what they told us, you know, was clearly subject to substantial change because it was such a fluid environment. But our ability to get on the phone with the smaller companies we're investing in, companies that we've been in investors in for a long period of time, have relationships with the senior management. Clearly, we thought the information flow was extremely advantaged in the, you know, in the COVID world.
Bob, a more macro question: interest rates. How does that affect the industry, the business, and what's your view on where we might be headed?
So interest rates, right? So the 10-year treasury today is a money-losing proposition, right? Because you get 1% if you're lucky, and inflation is 1.5% to 2%. So you're losing money on a real basis, assuming the 10-year treasury price doesn't move anyplace in the next year. So we think there's... So I'd suggest, of course, right, there's a fixed income bubble. That's where the bubble is today, in fixed income markets. And interest rates are of course, managed by the federal governments, right? The Fed is depressing the stock price by buying all of the government's issuance, which is significant and growing. So how sustainable is the interest rates? Yes, inflation's dead, and yes, interest rates will never go up again. That's a very dangerous presumption because the facts say there's something different going on. And we can understand why it is happening. And you could say, well, why is it going to stop? That's true. So, and of course, that's one of the huge benefits that's going on in home building today is that low mortgage rates are therefore clearly affecting affordability. And so therefore, that's an extra tailwind for the business. We think there's risks to that, right? The idea that interest rates stay where they are, that they tick up, that therefore mortgages cost more money. Therefore, that starts to affect home pricing. So that is definitely a mitigating factor, or can be, and we would almost expect it to happen in the next few years. That said, people need to live someplace. If they rent someplace, our thoughts are the, you know, cost of rental, demand, the population is going to determine where am I going to live, what's the cost of it going to be. And so I do think that the lack of availability, and that's what it is, right? Coming into this, the inventory of homes available for sale is at extremely low levels. It's at all-time lows. So therefore, you're not selling in a, always risk in a commodity business is there's too much inventory. And so therefore you change the level of activity and you've got way too much inventory. And so I just don't think that that's the risk here. There's a shortage of housing, I would suggest, and that's not changing. And therefore, even if it gets more expensive And so what it, and the other part of expensive is, right, 62%, 63% of Americans do own their home. And so there is a wealth effect associated with it. And clearly the last number of years, the last year or two for sure, home prices in America have appreciated. And so that's a significant factor. And also, it used to be in America, of course, everybody said you always want to own your home because it's a no-lose proposition. It only goes up in value. And of course, 10 years ago, that was proven wrong because people bought homes they couldn't afford. They lost the home. They lost a lot of money. And so the idea that homes only go in one direction, you know, we now know that they can go down in price. And so that is a risk. But I'd suggest to you we're on the other side of that equation today, that costs of homes are going to go up because the land costs more money. The materials cost more money. The labor costs more money. So the replacement cost of homes is going, has gone higher, will continue to go higher because of shortages. And those shortages are driven by substantial reductions in capacity given what happened 10 years ago. And so we're living through that today. So I do think that we'll see higher interest rates. I don't think that's going to change the fact that people need a place to live. And it could clearly change the attitude in terms of, well, it's only 4% today and it was 3% a year ago. It's going to 5%. So therefore, I better get in now. And the home prices have gone up and they're going to go up more. So it changes the psychology and accelerates people's thoughts that I should own a home and I should own it now. So I really think that there are mitigating factors that mitigate the risk associated with likely higher interest rates over time.
Bob, for a company like Builders FirstSource, on the capital allocation side going forward, where would you set the priorities?
It's an interesting question because I don't know the answer to that. And this is what I mean by that. So first off, in the combination, since BMC was almost debt-free, the level of debt's come down dramatically. And Builders FirstSource always said, we want to operate with 2.5 to 3 times, you know, debt to EBITDA levels. And so they're nowhere near that. And they're generating a lot of free cash. And both of them are generating a lot of free cash in the last couple of years. And they're probably going to generate more free cash in the current environment. So therefore, I can't see, and there are acquisition opportunities, right? The acquisition opportunities, though, are who's the trust plant in Albuquerque that they want to buy, or who's the distributor in Kansas they're going to buy. But those purchases are going to be 30 million, 40 million, 100 million. So they're going to be rounding errors in how much cash they're going to be generating. So I see no way for them to lever up to what they said they would do because they could continue to do organic. And those in-market acquisitions, you know, are dramatic in terms of improving the profitability in that market for them and positioning them to continue to then make organic investments too. So there's a great growth opportunity to continue to consolidate some of the smaller players and add a lot of profitability in those markets. But yet that can't possibly consume the cash they'll generate. So I'm not exactly sure what they do with the extra cash. I'm not concerned given, you know, the who's on the board and, you know, how they think about capital allocation and how I know those people and have conviction they're going to figure out things that are value added for investors. They have a problem, and the problem is they're going to generate a lot more cash than they can redirect in their core business.
Well, terrific. This has been really excellent, Bob. Before we break here, if I may just switch gears a little bit, given your expertise, I feel like I'd be remiss not to ask you about energy and your latest thoughts in that sector.
We think energy is where home building was in 09. Sorry, no, in 11. So in 09, we bought it. In 11, it went to half of where Builders FirstSource was when we bought it. We think we're there in energy today, right? We think, again, it's specific. Which of the companies we're invested in? What are the nature of those businesses? What's the nature? Who's the controlling shareholders of many of those situations? What are the opportunity sets in front of it? So, you know, in a macro sense, right? Onshore oil shale has had, you know, is the most significant thing that's happened to the industry in the decade of 2010, and that's gone away. It clearly was already demonstrated in aggregate. It was not profitable. It didn't generate cash, and therefore, you know, the bloom was off the rose before COVID came in terms of what the activity level was onshore, what the production level was, and that incremental production onshore, of course, oversupplied the world markets, and that continually happened, adding almost 1 million barrels a day for an extended amount of time. Well, that's gone the other way. That's not coming back anytime soon. To keep its level of production probably is as best it could hope for. In the meantime, you had, you know, beginning in the price fall in 2014, you had the capital that was the dramatic reduction generally, but then in 16 and 17, when prices recovered, a huge amount of capital came in, but it all went into onshore shale. And the production that it brought online has already gone away. So therefore, what capital has been invested was concentrated in an area that didn't give you permanent production. So we think that there's a continued decline. What also is happening today is, right, the world is, we're moving away from fossil fuels. We're going a different direction. And therefore, the major oil companies, especially the Europeans, are saying, well, you're going to significantly adjust our capital and a significant portion is going to go into the renewables business. So, A, I think that's a historically major oil companies investing in a business that's other than the oil business has been poor allocations of capital. Doesn't mean that those other businesses don't make huge amount of sense. You know, the growth of renewables clearly makes sense and is a, you know, a clear aspect. I don't think oil companies have the capability to do that. But what it also does, it takes more money out of the reinvestment in developing new reserves. And so, and that's what you have, continual decline of every existing well, production declining, the reluctance to put capital in for the future, given the uncertainty and this idea of stranded capital. So it seems to me the concern about peak oil, which is out there, clear, undeniable, and it's coming, is going to drive shortages of production long before we get to peak oil, because people aren't reinvesting today and haven't reinvested. And where do you reinvest? So we do think that the offshore place, you know, offshore is an interesting place. We think Canada is an interesting place. So those are two sub-markets we think have been starved for capital and done poorly in the last 4 years, but that's where the best opportunities are. And that's where some really, really good companies are and really well-positioned. And so we think there's a great opportunity for an extended recovery in those businesses that will benefit from all of the things and COVID accelerating that process, right? The decline in consumption reduced things, changed a capital-intensive business, reduced capital investment, and all of that has an impact. And therefore, supply-demand comes back into balance. And if anything, there's a, we think a likelihood of the next couple of years, there's actually shortages of oil in the short term. And then natural gas is the other thing, right? We do talk about oil, but natural gas is already, you know, half the production of the major oil companies. And it's definitely a bridge fuel. Even the people resist natural gas because they say once you put in a natural gas power plant, you know, that really changes the, you know, eventually it means you're still burning the hydrocarbon. So there's opposition to that. But yet in the interim, that's the way to help bridge. It's also partners well with renewables that have intermittent issues, so therefore have the reliability for the system and have power. So we think natural gas is growing for the next 20, 30 years, probably continues to grow in terms of its production and its consumption. And that's a critical opportunity for the oil and gas business as it becomes more of a gas business. So that's another opportunity we think people are kind of missing that is latent in our investments.
Terrific. Well, that's very helpful. Just perhaps before I let you go, Bob, on a personal note, I know this has been a strange year for all of us in the community due to COVID. And as you know, at MOI, we've had to basically switch exclusively to these online events. And, you know, one of my most cherished memories was having you at Idea Week St. Moritz a couple of years ago. And I truly hope we can resume those events in the near future. And I hope you'll consider joining us again at some point.
Well, John, this is great for you because you dislike traveling, right? So therefore, the world moves to you. But I do think it's also interesting how I think everyone's learned the new method to conduct business meetings, to do things. And so there's an extra arsenal that all of us have. And I also think it's interesting. It almost seems to me as if people don't work like, you know, 8 to 5 or whatever the hours are, you know, because everybody's online, everybody's available all the time. So it almost seems to me as if you could do more work, you could do more things, you have more ways to communicate with people. And in a year's time or 2 years time, we'll be back in St. Moritz and we'll see each other again. And we'll do all those things because that will happen also. This is not the new norm either, that we're all can't communicate, can't see each other. So we've got an extra arrow in the quiver. And that's one of the benefits that you get from a difficult time.
Very well said, Bob. Thank you so much. Terrific. And I look forward to seeing you again. In the meantime, we'll stick to this online format. Okay. Thanks again.
Very good. Thanks again. Thanks to you all for listening in. Appreciate it very much. Take care.
Bye-bye. Take care, Bob. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.